Good afternoon. You are listening to Dawnland Signals on WERU-FM. I am your co-host, Maria Gerard.
And I am your co-host, Esther Ann.
Dawnland Signals is a monthly talk show where we hold space for critical conversations of truth, healing, and change here in the Dawnland. We explore topics such as restorative justice, restorative practices, decolonization, and cultural revival. Our guests are people involved in aspects of truth, healing, and change work. This program is offered in an effort to share, inspire, and inform. Dawnland Signals is a collaboration of Maine Wabanaki Reach and WERU-FM.
Welcome. My name is Esther Ann, and today we are having a conversation remembering the Truth Commission in Maine. The Maine Wabanaki State Child Welfare Truth and Reconciliation Commission was a historic process in Maine and actually in the country. It's the only official truth commission in the United States that addressed Native child welfare. And June is the fifth anniversary of the release of the commission's report. They were seated in February of 2013, and they completed a 27-month investigation into what happened and what is happening to Wabanaki people in state child welfare in Maine. So we are very pleased to have with us here three of the five commissioners that served with us today. We have Carol Wishkemper, Sandy Whitehawk, and Gail Werbach. And we're just going to have a conversation. It's kind of like a little reunion as well, because Maine Wabanaki Reach created and established the Truth and Reconciliation Commission process, and we supported the commission in fulfilling their mandate. We educated folks and recruited people and supported people through the truth-telling process, and we're also involved in implementing the 14 recommendations that the commission issued. So I just want to start off and have our guests introduce themselves and talk a little, maybe share your most memorable moments from that process. It was such, you know, as we look back and we say, oh, we could have spent 5 years or 10 years doing this investigation. There was so much to learn. And you all did you did a lot of work in a short period of time. So there must be some real memorable moments. And so why don't we start with Carol?
Thank you. I'm Carol Wishkemper. I co-chair the commission with Gisa Tanamuk. I'm really sorry he's not here today. It's hard for me to think about the fact that it's been 5 years since we issued our report, and we only had 2.25 years to do the work and to issue the report. So time sort of feels fungible in this way, and that it feels like yesterday and it feels like a long time ago. In terms of memorable moments, it feels almost like looking at my life and realizing that some of my most vivid memories are from photographs that I've been shown about my life. And so the Dawnland video skews a lot in terms of having seen that now numerous times. Those are the memories that sort of come forward. So I don't want to talk about any of those because we've all seen them, and hopefully many of our listeners have seen Dawnland, the video. And if they haven't, I would highly recommend that they do. It, in some ways, is its own story and not necessarily the story that I lived, but I think it's a useful picture of the experience that we had. I just want to say we laughed a lot, we cried a lot, and we learned to love a lot, coming out of it with deep friendships and relationships. And I'd say, as I think about it, a memorable moment was when we all came together, the commissioners and our executive director, Charlotte Bacon, after having spent weeks reading transcripts. We divided up the transcripts in that we couldn't read them all. Some of them overlap, but we each had a section. And when we talked about the themes that were in the portion of the transcripts that we read, it all fell together. And the story was like a jigsaw puzzle where we each held pieces. And once we found the corners and the edges, the story emerged. And I think that the report surprised us all in terms of how coherent it was, how salient it was, how relevant it was. And we titled it Beyond the Mandate because we knew that it was just the beginning of the long trail of work that was before REACH and others to carry out that mandate. So I'll stop there. I'm eager to hear what the rest of you have as memories, but I remember we were actually in this room where I'm sitting today where we did the theme comparison. I'm feeling it.
Now Sandy, so pleased you're here with us. You're on the radio. You're in Minnesota right now. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and share some memories?
Sure. Petuashde, Chantewashde, Onapeche, Yuzapi. Good afternoon or good day, relatives. Greetings to all of you out there in cyberspace or radio space, whatever we call that space now. I want to say a special greeting to anyone who's been impacted by the child welfare process and who may be looking to find their way back to their community, who may be needing that healing from separation, not just the person who was taken, but the family that was left behind. I want you to know that there are prayers being said regularly in all tribal nations during all our ceremonies. Yeah, you are not alone. So I was the only commissioner who was from out of state. And I hadn't thought about that until I actually was beginning our first visitations to tribal lands. I knew I wanted to be part of the process and was shocked that I was chosen to be part of the process. I think one of my very first memorable moments is meeting these other commissioners and seeing their expertise, seeing their spirit, seeing their heart. And every one of us said, I can't believe that I got picked. And we confessed that the first night that we met before the seatings. That was kind of interesting. And yet I could see why they were chosen, and they would say, well, we of course can see why you're chosen. But it was so, the humility in each of the commissioners was so, what a beautiful gift that was. But what really, I think for my, this is just a personal reaction that I had, was the daunting responsibility of being on someone else's homeland, respecting that homeland and not having an expectation, and to listen and to watch so that there'd be no, that we wouldn't hurt anyone. Because while we are very similar as Indian people, there are some things and we always know we're a visitor, regardless of whether we're Indian people or not too, we're visiting a homeland. So that's my first memorable thing. I say, oh my gosh. And to be with our Eastern relatives, the relatives who first experienced that first onslaught of massacres and disease, and here they were. I mean, there are people in the Midwest who were asking me, do they still have a language? Yes, they're there. They can't be a federally recognized tribe if they haven't. But yet our own people, you know, we are not aware of on the East Coast anyway, as aware of who they are. So I had a lot of fun educating people back here and just saying that, yes, they're there. And they are powerful and beautiful, and what an honor it was honor just doesn't even seem to fit. You know, we say that all the time, but just was an amazing blessing to be there to listen and to carry their stories and their experiences forward.
Thank you, Sandy. This is Esther again. I have been also moved and blessed by meeting tribal people out west, and you know, when they find out that Wabanaki, they're grateful. They're like, thank you so much. You know, we appreciate all the sacrifices that your people have made so that we can, you know, thrive. And so I've encountered that. And I've also encountered, oh, there's still Indians in Maine. So it runs the gamut, right? And Gail, thank you for being here today. Want to introduce yourself and share some memorable moments?
Sure. I'm Gail Werbach, one of the commissioners. I'm retired right now, but for 30 years, I was on the faculty of the School of Social Work at the University of Maine, and about half of that time as a director of the school. And Esther Ann's claim to fame, she was one of my first advisees. I know Esther loves when I tell that story. When I came to UMaine, the first person who I knew was Native American. I'm sure I met other Native Americans in my life, but it didn't register for me in my white world. And I think became involved with several Indian Child Welfare grants back in the early 90s. The federal government was really trying to increase the number of Native American social workers period, and the number of students who could come into our bachelor's and master's degree programs from tribal communities all over the country. And we were fortunate to have a number of those grants and to see the increase in the number of Native students who came into social work. Because in Maine, when I first got here, with the exception of the Penobscot Nation, I believe really a majority of tribal child welfare positions were filled by white social workers. And so I think changed, and there's a lot of things that's changed in my 30 years in Maine. I mirror a lot of what Carol and Sandy have said. I also had that feeling of humility in terms of being a part of the commission. I think the memories that I have are all about how complicated what we were trying to do turned out to be. And that, you know, I went into it with my faculty administrator director head about, you know, let's arrange this and organize this and let's do this. And that got challenged pretty much from the beginning. Number one, that's a very white view of how to enter a community. And also it was coming from that same white stance of, I know the way to do things. So that I think was challenged and rightly challenged from the very, very beginning. So I learned I guess for me personally, there was just so much that I learned about the hidden, from a white person's perspective, the hidden nature of privilege that doesn't get recognized until you really put yourself in positions of having that challenged. One of the first events that I attended, the other movie I will put a plug in for is Georgiana's movie, the am I getting that? I think I'm getting
Dear Georgina. Dear Georgina. Georgina.
One of the first meetings that I ever attended, I was the only commissioner there. It was sort of a beginning introduction for the Sabaic community, well, also for the Passamaquoddy. And there were a huge number of folks there, and she came up to talk to me afterwards about her experiences in foster care, and I'll always remember that piece. I guess the other memories I have are the piece of this process that I did take seriously is I saw myself as somebody who also represented the social work profession, and in particular the social work profession as carried out by white social workers. And so that was something that I saw was important to talk about the accountability of the profession, to make the profession accountable, to say something about the responsibility and the poor decisions and the beyond poor, the traumatic decisions and horrible decisions that social workers had made, not just in Maine, but in other communities. I felt like that was a part of the process that I needed to bring to this commission, and that was very humbling because I remember so many folks from the tribal communities thanking me for saying that. And it was after all of the horrendous impact that the profession had had on tribal families, to then have members of the community thank me was kind of overwhelming. Anyway, I could go on and on, but it was certainly one of the most amazing personally and professionally for me in my 30 years as an academic. It was an incredible learning piece for me.
Thank you so much. This is Maria. Thank you so much for sharing all those memories. It really just sort of takes me right back. I just wanted to add that those videos that have been mentioned so far, Dawn Land and Dear Georgina, those videos are film projects by Upstander, and more information about those videos can be found on their website at www.dawnland.org.
Thank you, Maria. I wanted to read I was looking through the report again in preparation for our call, and I was trying to find, you know, one really good moving passage, but I ended up reading the whole thing because it's full of good passages. So I want to just read one part. It's on page 12 of the report, and it's the beginning of the letter that the commission wrote to set up the report. And I just want to read this part. Quote, "From our perspective, to improve Native child welfare, Maine and the tribes must continue to confront 1, underlying racism still at work in state institutions and the public. 2, ongoing impact of historical trauma, also known as intergenerational trauma, on Wabanaki people that influences the well-being of individuals and communities. 3, differing interpretations of tribal sovereignty and jurisdiction that make encounters between the tribes and the state contentious." So I was drawn to that part, especially in when you started talking, Gail, again about the system, the social work profession, and how systemic changes are necessary, that it really reinforced that I should read that portion of the report. So thinking about what is contained in the report and, you know, all of the statements, 160, I believe, statements the commission gathered, and they're archived at Bowdoin College on their website. The video, there's some videos, audio transcripts, and the written transcripts of statements. All of the statement gathering and then all of this information in the report. I remember, talking about memories, I remember the day we gathered at Penobscot Nation and you came to share. We were the first people to hear the findings and recommendations, and it was such an emotional day. I remember feeling we were all anxious on pins and needles and just and felt so relieved because we felt so validated by what you found. I was, this is Esther, if you're just tuning in, Esther Ann. I was honored to be part of this process from the very beginning in 1999, and so many lessons that we had to learn about letting go and trust in the process. Yes. That was such a recurring theme. even when we created the commission and you all were seated, the day before your seating ceremony, we had a hard time letting go, right? One of our elders in the group said, "You're our baby, and you're flying away from the nest, but you can always come back." Remember that analogy? That was sweet. So I think about, maybe you can, the three of you would want to weigh in a little on what you see as the impact of this truth-telling process and, you know, and the report itself on Wabanaki and Maine communities, from what you've observed or what you know in your own community, and even the impact it's had on you wherever you are and whatever work that you're doing.
This is Sandy. I was just over here laughing when you were talking about the report, the writing, and because for our listeners, REACH was every time we gathered with REACH because they were part of the process in terms of what brought us there, and then they were the experts to tell us, you know, that we consulted with and went with us to the reservations, and then when it came time for the report, we said, "All right, guys, bye, see you. You can't come in because we're going to write the report now." And they were like, "What? No way, you are not." They are like, "No, you cannot be here. We need to do this on our own." And it was, you know, that was a challenge for REACH. And I giggle about it now because I'm thinking, what'd you think we were going to write? You know, we all saw the same thing. When you think about it, it's kind of funny. But anyway, so it was a relief for them to hear, you know, the first recommendation, respect tribal sovereignty. And I think even so, I was the person in the film that says, this is nothing new. We all know this. We all have seen this. We've lived it. So there's nothing new in this report. What I believe it does, the power that it has, is it took this oral history of individuals, the generations, because we didn't hear just present day other, you know, people often told us generationally things, experiences with child welfare and other things that happened in the community. But what it gave then is, so for us, oral history is alive, and it's the citation for our, whenever we want to speak of something as this is the authority, it's that person, that elder who's told the story, that's our authority. Mm-hmm. Academically, it has to be through an IRB process, and then it's an authority because it went through this process and it's on a piece of paper, and now it's an authority that way. So these two forms of authority come together. And so in our communities, in the Indian communities, all these oral histories came forward or documented. And so both sides are honored. What is different for us is that finally the experiences were seen and used in a way to educate in a way much differently than just saying, well, this happened to me and nobody cared. This time it was, oh, that happened for real? And so it will now be seen and heard for generations. And no one can deny now the systematic racism, the systematic removal of children, and the decimation that it had on families. So that's quite powerful. And finally, our oral histories were recognized and seen for what they were, and not just complaints. These are historic instances within communities.
Thank you, Sandy. This is Esther. I remember one of our early meetings before we, you know, back in 2008 when we were just conceptualizing this process. One of the goals that we had at the time is we were tired of rehashing this story, you know, this truth, and always trying to say we wanted to get it out on the table and have an agreed upon, this is truth. This happened. Let's stop arguing over the facts. Let's get it out. Let's talk about it and move through, you know, the process that we have to do for healing. and so we can create some change and get some work done for Native children and families. So I really appreciate this report. And all along we kept saying, we're not just going to let it be words, you know, sitting on somebody's shelf. It's going to be a living document. It's going to be used. And so I really appreciate it. And it's also the most beautiful. The hard copy is the most beautiful document, and we are actually, to celebrate the fifth year anniversary of this report, we're giving away a wellness basket, and we're going to include one of these written reports, because I have, I think, maybe four left of all the ones that you all had printed. So it's a treasure for sure. So one lucky person is going to get that on June 30th. So Carol, do you have anything to add about impact of the report that you have seen?
A lot. I have a lot there.
Great.
So I think one of the significant moves that we made in creating the report was to look beyond the mandate, which is the title of the report, but we were looking beyond the narrow interpretation of the mandate to investigate what was going on in child welfare. And I think our thinking was similar to Reach's in, when you all decided that it was time for Truth and Reconciliation Commission, that we really needed to look underneath what was happening in child welfare at the systemic forces that were creating that. That technical changes to child welfare weren't going to do what was needed to do, that we needed to look at the larger scope of the issue. So you just read the three major findings, which were to respect tribal sovereignty, to recognize the institutional racism that exists both in government and the general population, and to understand the fact that intergenerational trauma is real and it impacts people's lives in the present. I'm going to talk about impact in a broad way, in that nothing is ever finished. It's all an emerging story. Respect tribal sovereignty. This summer, when the commission or the task force was created to look at the Indian Land Claims Act and the Implementing Act, and the recommendations that came out of that commission that were supported by consensus by a bipartisan group of, I think, 13 people coming together, all of which looked at how tribal sovereignty has been disturbed by the legislation coming out of the Indian Land Claims Act. And I think there were 13 recommendations, all which were pointing in the direction of the main tribes having the same rights of sovereignty that tribes in other parts of the country have. And it seemed like it was moving along. It hit a big bump, but then COVID-19 shut the legislature down. And so we don't know how that story was going to come out. But for me, of all the things in my heart of heart putting together this report, was that until that issue was addressed, the issue of sovereignty and how it's enacted between the state of Maine and the tribes, that's the knot that's holding all of this piece together. So I don't know whether or not the words in our report helped to lead to that commission's formation. I doubt it. I wouldn't give us that much influence or power. But we started talking about it 5 years ago. And as Sandy said, we were a mandated, we were an official body mandated by the state of Maine, approved by the governor and the tribal chiefs. And we put that out as a strong statement. And so whatever the jelly beans are that lead to however things happen, I think that most of the people on that commission probably were not aware of our work, but I was pleased to see our work resulting in that move. I think that was really important.
This is Esther again. I was at the first meeting of that commission when they got together in Augusta, and Penobscot Chief Kirk Francis referenced the Maine Wabanaki State Child Welfare Truth and Reconciliation Commission process. So as he always had for throughout the whole process, he in particular stood out as one of the chiefs that really saw the potential for this process to be used in other areas of tribal state relations. He put it on record there anyway, so he remembered.
I want to say one other thing. So I think that we were trying to honor the truth that we were asked to bring forward by making that recommendation. And I think we also were bold in terms of not shying away from using the term genocide, and that genocide happened here in Maine, and that it's still in some ways embedded into our fiber in terms of the cultural and social genocide that still is being perpetuated.
Thank you. You are listening to Dawnland Signals on WERU-FM. I am your co-host, Maria Gerard, along with co-host Esther Ann. Dawnland Signals is a monthly talk show where we hold space for critical conversations of truth, healing, and change. And today we are remembering the Truth Commission in Maine. And with us to help reminisce are special guests Sandy Whitehawk, Carol Wishkamper, and Gail Warbach, three members of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Thank you, Maria. This is Esther Ann, and we were just talking, focusing on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission report, which is the fifth anniversary of the report, is on the 14th, I believe. June 14th was the day that it was released. Yeah, and we're currently talking about the impact of that, and I'd like to hear from Gail now to share some thoughts.
This is Gail. I would agree with Carol in terms of the report hopefully having an impact in terms of tribal sovereignty. What I was thinking about while I was listening to everybody was, for me, there were sort of all these little snippets that may be kind of incremental, but hopefully lead to some bigger changes. And I think about a lot of the interviews that I was involved with was the child welfare community, the largely white practitioners, both current and retired, also some judges. And so some of the things that I think of for impact are, for example, that the judges, the state judges, have an annual meeting, and you could see the light bulb go off with a couple of the judges that I did interviews with, that they needed folks coming from Wabanaki Reach to help inform all of the state judges, to help them really understand what had happened to tribal communities, because those are the folks hearing child custody cases for in various circumstances within the state. And you could see it was a light bulb going off for people. Whether that's led to major changes, I don't know at this point, but I think definitely for some of the judges, they saw that there was a need for a lot more understanding about how their decisions were impacting tribal kids and families. And the other piece, I think, was probably the poignant changes. And again, I think it was on a very powerful but personal level. A number of the retired social workers that I talk with, who could really give a long-term history in the days when I think there was less turnover in the child welfare offices, the ones who were really open to this process really thought back on decisions that they had made in tribal communities and those ramifications, and basically how horrible it was. Mm-hmm. And they really spoke to that and really processed that and started to think about what had really happened in those, you know, in those years. Because I think as Carol said, in some ways we went beyond the mandate, because we also heard from not just folks who had been impacted since the Indian Child Welfare Act, but also from generations before. And those were really, mm-hmm. Those were really powerful. And so I guess my hope is that that the Department of Human Services, Health and Human Services, Child Welfare, didn't just file the report away, and that they're still pushing towards the education, the training, and the self-awareness. That's the big part of it. Not just you know, let's go read 5 points for how to work with a tribal family, but more, let's see what's going on inside ourselves and how we respond in working with tribal children and families, and what assumptions we make and what assumptions we don't make, and how we make those, you know, how we make those decisions. I guess I would hope that the report, and maybe this 5-year anniversary, is an opportunity for the department to go back and see what did they do with the report, how did they incorporate that into the next generation of social workers, how did the social workers who've been in the system for a long time, how are they bringing their knowledge, the good, the bad, the ugly, into the education for the new social workers coming up. So I hope those are some changes that have happened.
Thank you, Gail. This is Esther Ann. I'd be happy to provide a couple updates if that would be helpful. Yeah. Yeah. So one of the 14 recommendations that you issued, number 8, was to fund the renewal of the ICWA work group and involve them in designing and implementing training so that all levels of leadership are involved. And that, I'm happy to report, happened even before it happened, I think, before you even released your report, before you even released your recommendation. The state did commit to and has provided the funding to be able to have that ICWA work group back up and running. So since August of 2015, I actually have been facilitating the ICWA work group through my job at the Muskie School. We have a contract with the state to provide some services, and this is one of them. And we absolutely have taken this report and used it as our work plan when we first got together, because 7 of the 14 recommendations are real specific to child welfare, and we have been making a lot of progress on them. The ICWA work group is such a dynamic, committed group. And I tell people that the tribes and states sitting down together every other month to talk about child welfare in a co-case management framework. It's not, you know, the state and the tribes are just these outside agencies. They're co-case managers on all ICWA cases. The policies that have been written and the practice that is reinforced goes beyond ICWA. It goes above and beyond just the letter of the law. It really incorporates the spirit of the law. For example, and I don't want to get too technical for the non-child welfare folks, but ICWA requires that when a Native child is taken into state child welfare custody, they notify the tribe at the time of custody. For Wabanaki tribes in the state of Maine, as soon as an intake comes in, the tribe is contacted at the very outset to do the assessment with that worker, because the state, you know, state recognizes that not only is that best practice, it makes their jobs a lot easier, but they also recognize that ICWA is the gold standard of child welfare practice and policy. So a lot of good things have happened. We have been we've been educating and recruiting Wabanaki people to serve as ICWA qualified expert witnesses, which is a requirement of ICWA. Again, some technical things that people might not understand, but a lot of good work is coming out of the ICWA work group. We have strong representation from OCFS, from tribal partners, and from the AG's office. So when ICWA was being attacked, is under attack right now with the Brakeen case. If anybody wants to Google that, you can just Google Brakeen ICWA and you'll get all the information, or you can even watch Blood Memory, which we might have some time to talk about here, Sandy. You'll see that ICWA is under attack, and Maine has filed in support, those amicus briefs in support of ICWA. So, and a lot of that is, you know, they look to the ICWA work group for our expertise. So, and we have been training judges and educating outside workers. And so it's wonderful. Things that happen here between the tribes and the state around child welfare don't happen in other parts of the country. So there's a lot to be proud of here.
That's wonderful. And I wanted to acknowledge you, Esther Ann, because you've spent so many of your years working in this field, and it's obvious and easy to hear. in all that you have to say. Thank you for sharing all of that information. You are listening to Dawnland Signals on WERU FM. Dawnland Signals is the monthly talk show where we hold space for critical conversations of truth, healing, and change. And today we are remembering the Truth Commission in Maine with special guests Sandy Whitehawk, Carol Wishcamper, and Gail Rohrbach.
Thank you, Maria. This is Esther. So the third discussion point that I kind of wanted us to spend some time on, and it's I wrote these discussion points a while ago, so a lot of things have happened, but when I look at it, I really like to talk about what lessons from this process. Carol talked a little bit about the LD2094 in the state of Maine, which is around the Maine Implementing Act, and how we talked about how Chief Francis had recognized that this process could be useful. So the lessons that we learned from this process, what would help us today in addressing some of the current issues, which are many happening right now? I don't know if anybody, Carol, would like to talk about that.
Before I talk about that, I'm wanting to add one more really important factor to the impact of the work. And that's the ongoing work of Maine Wabanaki Reach in terms of addressing what we had is one of our key findings, the racism that exists institutionally and in the Maine population. And Maine is not immune. Maine is not unlike other places. But I think the work that Maine Wabanaki Reach has done in the last 5 years in terms of educating white Mainers about the Native history, what it means to be a Native Mainer today, it's phenomenal. I don't know that I'm up with all of the numbers, but I think you probably had over 500 people. What's the number, Esther, in terms of the people that have been part of Wabanaki Reach's workshops?
Oh, Maria. I'm looking to our director, Maria.
I think we are very close to about 1,000 people so far who have participated in our workshops.
That's what I would have guessed. And one of the things that I think, we have qualitative ways of knowing, but there are also quantitative ways of knowing. The number of white allies that have shown up in Augusta to stand with Native people on the Violence Against Women Act passage, which was amazing, and then with the more recent legislation about the Settlement Act, there were so many people, they couldn't fit in the room. They had to pipe it out into additional rooms. There's so much energy about support for Native people in the state now that wasn't here before.
Yes.
And I just want to say thank you to Maine Wabanaki Reach. You conceived the commission, and then you stayed with it in terms of carrying out the recommendations. And the results are tangible. So thank you.
Thank you, Carol.
This is Sandy. I want to add to what Carol has shared that one of the major impacts the commission has had is that white people know that there are Indian people in Maine. I would guess if you would have surveyed the average, even college student, how many tribal nations exist in your state, they would have gone, huh? Tribal nations? What does that mean? And yet here are, that's why it was so important to have the first recommendation be recognize tribal sovereignty. So, but beyond that, knowing that the there is vital for social workers, because in the film Dawnland, that there's a social worker that says, it's somewhat of a myth that there is a culture up north. And the fact that they chose that word myth speaks to how the, not being aware. And so the truth, while those of us that know the truth just, you go, oh my gosh, we laugh, we have all kinds of reactions to that. But that truth right there, just if that's the only thing that ever came out of this process, just to know that you exist is huge. People literally do not know that we are here. In fact, right now, if you Google African-American, modern-day African-Americans will pop up, or if you Google Asian-American, But if you Google Native American, you know what pops up? 1800s pictures.
Mm. Yeah.
The president of the National Congress of American Indians will not pop up. The, no tribal leadership will pop up, nothing. Mm. Only just that old stuff. So that's how Google doesn't even have us in the present day. So that's huge to have it not be a myth that they exist. So
thank you, Sandy. This is Esther. I just wanted to give a shout out again to all the people who provided statements.
Yes.
The 90 plus Wabanaki people who shared, and the state folks, the caseworkers, the judges, the foster parents, the police officers, and the caseworker that's on Dawnland saying that, what courage. I mean, I just have so much appreciation for people being that vulnerable and sharing so that other people can learn from it. I just have a lot of respect for people who are able to do that, to learn, share and then learn from it. So
and to have a statement come in that said from a social worker that we believed safety first, ICWA second, as if Indian social work theory or belief was that children should stay in abusive homes. That's still a concept. We're still continually fighting that. Mm-hmm. So what was brought out, there's so many things that were brought out, but the fact that, the truth is the truth and can't be changed. And it's how we accept and work with that truth. So if it's a really hard, ugly truth, it is a hard, ugly truth, but that has to come before any kind of compassion or wisdom can come. So that process of it, but it's important to understand and share what people have believed was the truth and what the truth really is.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for that. I'm enjoying this conversation, and I wish that we could, talk forever and continue reminiscing. And I also want to echo Esther Ann's appreciation for Wabanaki people, and just to borrow the words of the film producer of Dawnland when he was, accepting this Emmy Award for Best Research on the film Dawnland. The film producer, Adam Mazo, stated that the greatest recognition belongs to the Wabanaki people. And I sincerely believe that as well. So many people giving of themselves so deeply so that children in the future didn't have to suffer. So my appreciation as well. And I just want to say that we have about 10 more minutes. So we're going to think about wrapping up. And I just wanted to ask if anyone had any final words, any final thoughts on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
I'd like to address the question that Esther asked about lessons from the TRC process that might be helpful in current issues, and I'll be quick and just name two that are really stand out. Right now, given all that's going on in the country, there's been a petition that's been put before the National Congress to create a national Truth and Reconciliation process. And I think that what we did here in terms of truth, healing, and change needs to be done at a national level to investigate what's going on right now in terms of COVID-19 and the veil, the curtain being pulled open in terms of the disparities, in terms of numbers of people, Native people, Black people, peoples of color. That was the first, and then now the visible police brutality and murder of Black and brown bodies. We need a Truth and Reconciliation, a Truth and Change Commission. I think one of the things I want to get into here is one of the things we learned along the way is the word reconciliation is not the appropriate word, that white people come wanting to reconcile, whereas for Native peoples or peoples of color, Black people, they're not ready to reconcile until they understand or can feel that white people are really coming with an apology in their heart, with effort to remediate, to repair. I think reparations are on the table in a way that they've never been before. I think we need to push for that in addition to the National Truth and Change Commission. And just one piece in Maine that goes to what Sandy just said. A week or so ago, there was an article in the Boston Globe about a painting, reference to ghosts of the Wabanaki people. And there have been numerous letters, including one really powerful one from the new director of the Abbey Museum, who's a Passamaquoddy man. Yay for the Abbey for bringing on a Native leader. But really, really refuting to the Globe the perpetuation of a myth that Native people are in the past. Native people are very in the present with a lot to contribute. And I think that one of the lessons of the TRC is being able to have people step forward and shine that light. So I could go on, but that's enough.
Thank you, Sandy. Gail, Carol. Look, I'm seeing all three of you. I'm going through all your names. Anybody else want to share? Do you have anything else you want to add? Parting thoughts, Gail?
Well, one thing, I don't know how much it comes from the commission work. I think it's a combination of things, but I find it interesting that again, I'm talking about something small but still big, is that now at the University of Maine, the president in any formal meeting, convocation, especially public events, recognizes where the University of Maine land is and who were the, that this is Penobscot land, that the university sits on Penobscot land. And certainly didn't hear that 30 years ago. I think that's also come from the work that's been done through the Native American Studies and through other kinds of links, but particularly, I think, between the university and the Penobscot Nation. But I was floored. I was to be able to hear that, at the beginning of comments made by the, you know, chief officer at the university, because, you know, the university basically got its land through subterfuge, and has never doesn't recognize that publicly. So there are all of these small but really meaningful events that I think are taking place across the university and across Maine. And unfortunately, we didn't have a graduation this year, but, you know, think about it. How many people from all over Maine who are still believing the myth of no Indians come to hear their kiddo graduate, and the president says, I want to acknowledge that we, the University of Maine, is on Penobscot land. I mean, that's one sentence, but at least it's going to raise people to say, what? You know, if they don't know that. So I hope it continues to happen.
It is a good first step. He could add stolen land to that sentence, and it would be a little more accurate. And then add a semicolon and say, and we'll give it back.
or he adds, and therefore all Penobscot tribal members can attend college tuition free as a reparation. That's what I'm wanting to hear. The land acknowledgments are another hour discussion that make me angry. That's all I'll say, because we can talk about it later. It's a first step, but I'm like, yeah. So what are you going to do about it?
This is Esther. I read the story of a college professor who took his student's water bottle, and he said, I acknowledge that this is your water bottle. And the student's like, yeah. So he goes, you're going to give it back to me? And he's like, no, I'm just acknowledging that I stole this from you.
Exactly.
So I agree with you, Sandy. So Sandy, do you have any closing thoughts you want to add?
That's my closing thought.
That is, okay.
That's my closing thought is I have a difficult time with these land acknowledgments, because they are an easy way out for non-Native people to say, well, now we've done the right thing. We were acknowledging this. They're not ushered into thinking further about what that means. And we shouldn't have to always do the education, but until we have enough people who know, we do have to educate and not be resentful about that. we have to say, well, think of what does that mean if it were stolen? What are you doing with the privilege that you have? What gifts can you return as a result of the privilege that you have? And I really believe these institutions of education really need to have, as a form of reparation, tribal citizens should be able to attend college as a result, and maybe even expand it to non-Penobscot, I mean, any tribal citizen, because we're all related. We see that as we're all related. That would be a true reparation and a true acknowledgement of stolen land.
Sandy, this is Gail. I think at this point, there are full tuition waivers for the tribal community members in Maine, but I think it's always in jeopardy, and I worry about it with the financial constraints that are going to be hitting the system, and also exactly what you say, it doesn't pertain to someone coming outside the state, and it's as complicated as the recognition of land issue. So, I worry about that.
Yeah. I wish we had another, this is Esther, I wish we had another hour to talk about UMaine tuition waiver, because I have a lot to say. But
Well, this sounds like a topic for another time, so we will keep that on the radar.
And I want to apologize for being so yakky. I thought the show was 2 hours, so sorry.
No, Sandy, we were counting on you for that.
I'm like, what? It's almost over. I thought we had another hour.
Well, with that, we are signing off. Thank you for listening to Dawnland Signals, and thank you to our very special guests for such a wonderful and enlightening conversation, Sandy Whitehawk, Carol Wishcamper, Gail Werbach, three commissioners of the historic Truth and Reconciliation Commission here in Maine. And perfect segue, Sandy was talking about land acknowledgments, and we're signing off with an acknowledgement of the land. We forgot to do that in the beginning, so let's just take a moment to acknowledge the land beneath our feet, Wabanakig, the land of the first light, the dawn land, land that has known Wabanaki ancestors, the tallest trees and the oldest rivers, land that has known peace and conflict, land that has nourished us and sustained us since time immemorial. We acknowledge the indigenous peoples of this land, Wabanakig, the Passamaquoddy, Penobscot, Mi'kmaq, Maliseet, and Abenaki, Ngadalnabam Nawik. We will be back the next month on the third Thursday, July 16th, for more conversations of truth, healing, and change.